Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Transitions Tuesday. Every Tuesday, you and I have the opportunity to learn about different kinds of transitions and different ways to transition from one state to another. So I am very pleased to welcome once again to the Mind Talk Airwaves, Dr. Adele Ryan McDowell. Dr. Ryan McDowell has written a lovely book entitled Balancing Act, Reflections, Meditations, and Coping Strategies for Today's Fast-Paced Whirl. And that is whirl as in W-H-I-R-L, which is indeed what life feels like for so many of us these days. Dr. Ryan McDowell, welcome.
Thank you very much, Dr. Brewer. And I'm thrilled to be talking to you again and thrilled to be talking about balance, because we're certainly living in upside down times.
Indeed, that's probably the gentlest way to put it. Tell us how you came to create Balancing Act.
I was very lucky. Several years ago, a dear friend of mine in the UK invited me to stay in her tiny little cottage with her two kitty cats and her container garden for 5 weeks while she traveled to see family in Australia. And I had 5 weeks to myself, unheard of. I'd never taken that much time off from work. It was amazing. And as I slowed down and began to decant, and, you know, there was no, for example, there was no clothes dryer. Couldn't get the word, clothes dryer. And so I'm hanging it out on the line. It became very meditative. You know, it was the end of summer and dying flowers. And I took a walk every day, and I just simmered into myself, and then I began to write. And that helped calm me down. I'm one of those people who needs to, like most of us, express myself. And just writing it down became helpful, and those became the seeds that became the book.
Well, you know, one of the things that's interesting about that, and I think I might be a little jealous about 5 weeks of just pure joy, but aside from that, you wear many hats. You're a psychotherapist, used to be in business, I think in corporate business, and then you became a psychotherapist. You teach meditation, intuition development, psycho-spiritual issues. You're an energy healer, and at the same time, you have worked with a broad range of experiences, which many people find really difficult not only to experience, but certainly to work with. Crisis, trauma, grief, suicide, domestic violence, sexual assault. I mean, if it's a trauma, it sounds like you have somehow been in the mix helping people to heal and recover.
I've been very fortunate. It's been some of my greatest gifts. I've been stretched beyond what I knew I was capable of holding in my heart and witnessing. When I think of Katrina, for example, or the floods in South Carolina, or Joplin tornado, Boston bombing, Newtown, Connecticut, the shooting there, all of those things, and meeting people at their rawest and often most shocked and disbelieving and heartsick, It has been a tremendous, tremendous privilege, and all of those things have changed me. They've made me a better person. I'm quite grateful for it.
It really is extraordinary how resilient people can be, often in the face of what one would think is just an incredible, can't survive it, can't go on another moment kind of experience, and yet people find a way to do just that, to go on and to heal and to recover, and then often to help.
Oh, it's amazing. I think of one darling, she was a small little grandmother, and I was in Biloxi in Gulfport area of Mississippi, and I'm there with the Red Cross, and we are doing things with food and whatever, and she said, no, that's way too much. Other people need more. Make sure they get what they need, right? It's just incredible that this woman had lost absolutely everything, but she wanted to make sure that everybody else got what they needed as well.
It is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Early on, you talk about the runaway brain. So other than the fact that most of us know exactly what you're talking about, what are you talking about?
That runaway brain is that brain of ours when we're not grounded fully in our body, and our brain is working overtime and going clickety, 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 and we're thinking about this, and that thought pings to another thought that pings to another thought, and we're doing circles and spirals and loop-de-loops, and we're not getting a lot of sleep, I'm telling you, because our brain, we are awake because our brain is awake. And I've had people say to me, oh, but though my body is so tired, but I can't stop my brain, right? And in Buddhism, the brain would be called monkey mind, right? We're chitter-chattering and going from branch to branch, but it is very hard to get into your body. And the deal is, and you know this because of your work, is that when you're in the body, you can feel your feelings. If you're in your head, you're in your thoughts. And the only way for any of us to heal is to feel our feelings. That's how we get from A to B. But calming the brain, you know, turning down the dial so that we are able to get some sleep and get calmer. You know, meditation certainly helps. Breathing certainly helps. Thinking of your feet being warm by the sun when you're lying in bed, that can be helpful. There are a lot of those things where you just say to yourself, okay, what's going on here? You know, sleep hygiene folks will tell you, get out of bed and go do something. You know, only sleep and sex in bed. But sometimes that doesn't work, and sometimes you have a runaway brain in the middle of the day, right? Okay. A client just left my office, and we'd had a rather tense couple session. She went one way, and her husband went another. And she sent me a text, and it was a picture of a license plate that said, no anxiety. That's it. What was going on with them? And I just laughed. I thought, well, the gods are talking to us, aren't they? Because, you know, and but then, you know, they talked about, I bet you've read this too, that if we go back in time, that survival of the fittest, there is a theory out there that those of us who have that strong survival of the fittest and perhaps are more wired about and worried, you know, as a woman said to me today, I come from a long line of worry warts, that it is actually taking that survival of the fittest to the nth degree with the worry. I mean, that's one thought. I mean, the other thought is if you've experienced this as a child, if you've experienced trauma, right, if you lived through a hurricane or a tornado, or if you had someone in the family who was very ill or substance abusing, and as a child you did not get what you needed, right, you're going to be aware and pick up things and be sensitive to things as well. And that can be a part of the runaway brain, too.
You talk about children and trauma and feeling the feelings, and you know that a lot of times children and adults, a way that they cope with the trauma is to dissociate from it as best they can. So to tell someone that feeling their feelings is a path toward healing, that's really difficult for them to swallow.
I totally agree. And children, it's normal for children to dissociate. It's a very, as you know, it's a common coping device. I always know if I find myself staring into space and twirling my hair, I've dissociated and I need to get back into my body, right? We all have our little things when we check out and we go, what are we doing here? I think with grown-ups, you know, saying to them, you know, we need you to get back into your body and to feel, but it's also remembering, I use this with kids, and when I was much younger, there would be double dip ice cream cones. They weren't real big scoops like there are now, but you could, you know, occasionally get a double dip. And to explain to children that feelings are like scoops of ice cream on an ice cream cone, and it's not good or bad, it just is. And that's the thing with feelings. They're not to be judged. And actually, they're guides for us, telling us what's going on with us, and so that we need to know. Even when we've got the runaway brain, we know, okay, what's going on here? What's going on with me? What triggered all of this that I'm on overload, right? Because often a runaway brain can signal we're not feeling in control, so we're trying to figure it out with our brain, right? Which is why some people I recommend before you go to bed, if you feel that wired, go write it down or write down your to-do list or something to get it out of you.
Mm-hmm.
Or for people who are fans of Grey's Anatomy and the Meredith Grey character says, okay, we're going to dance it out, right? So sometimes you just need to move it out of your body.
Something tells me that you're a fan of Grey's Anatomy.
Oh, I'm a fan of the Thursday night lineup. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Well, I'm sure that the networks are very happy with you. You know, you said something that I thought, it's a tiny little sentence, but it's really so powerful. And actually not one that I had thought about before, but one that, as I thought about it, made just tons of sense. When you say that you discover that waiting itself is a fiercely private matter. Can you say more about that? That's such a powerful observation.
Oh, thank you. It is true because we all have our own experience of waiting. One woman told me when she read that portion of the book, it gave her a lot of support. She was waiting for a health diagnosis, and most of us would be on edge waiting for something. And it helps her. It's because when you wait, you know, you're bringing all of you, all parts of you are sitting there as you're waiting. And you've got your expectations and your hopes and your dreams. You've got places, we all have places where we're in denial, couldn't possibly be. And you bring all of that with you. It's a very personal thing to wait. And when we're waiting for something big, it brings all of our vulnerability to the fore.
And perhaps sometimes, even if you're surrounded by scores of people, you can actually feel even more alone sometimes, and more into yourself when you're so surrounded with people who are doing their own things in terms of waiting.
Oh, I think that's very true. Again, it speaks to the individual nature of waiting. I recently had a loved one who had surgery, and we're all waiting in the waiting room, and I'm watching the different families and different people in the waiting room and how we're all responding, how we're taken from one waiting room to a smaller waiting room and going through this process, and some people are on their devices. Some people are pretending like they're reading a book. Some people are up and down running for cups of water or to the bathroom or anything because they can't sit still. But everybody's waiting and waiting for that moment when they know in this particular situation that their loved one is okay. It's an intensely private kind of thing because it's all of your innermost fears and expectations and vulnerabilities. And we human beings being human beings, when we're waiting and we're thinking about outcomes, how they're going to impact us. Some people are busy problem solving, or once I know that you're okay, then I'm going to do A, B, and C, because if they plan, they feel in control. And other people, if they tend to think worst case scenario, they are already bereft, even though they may not have to be bereft. As I said, it's a very private experience.
One of the things that strikes me throughout Balancing Act is that you're really providing space and an affirmation for human beings to be human beings. And so many times we take that away from ourselves. You talk about procrastination and you ask, of course, yet again, another really interesting question. Do you continually create these last minute emergencies so that you do not have to step in the fullness of who you are and accomplish what you really want to do in this lifetime? Explain that question and that concept.
Okay. Oh, you're asking great questions, and I love your comments. Thank you. Well, first of all, from a clinical point of view, if you've got ADD, that's your style. You do it now or you do it at the last minute. But for run-of-the-mill procrastinators, right, you are not plugging fully into your power for some fear of success or fear of failure, right? Well, oh, I didn't have time to do it properly. So, you build in something. So, I did it the last minute, you know, kind of the dog ate my homework routine. But on a bigger level, if we're procrastinating, we're putting off parts of ourselves because of fear, right? And we all have fear. That's part of this this process, right? Our journey of consciousness is facing our fears and saying, okay, I'm showing up here and I'm showing up there. So on one hand, we know procrastination might serve as a protective device until we're ready, right, to say, okay, I'm ready to do this. But if it becomes a habit pattern, I had one woman who said to me, why am I always late going to work? Why am I always late? And I said, well, I have two possible answers for you. One, you don't like the job and you don't want to be there. Or two, you're not planning properly and always think you can get out the door in 10 minutes when it takes you half an hour, right? And, you know, those are two easy answers, you know, that she was procrastinating getting ready in the morning. One woman said to me, I'd rather just sit in the bathroom and stare, because her life was overwhelming. And those were the few minutes that she had. So we procrastinate for all the reasons of being human, protect ourselves, out of fear, not ready to step into who we are. Carolyn Mace, I'm sure you're familiar with her. So, you know, she'll draw on the board her little energy person and how we get plugged in. And, you know, she has four archetypes, and one of them is the saboteur. And procrastination would be a kind of sabotage when we are not ready. You know, we're shooting ourselves in the foot, unconsciously usually, but we're shooting ourselves in the foot. Why? Because if we show up, more will be asked of us, and we're afraid we can't deliver. That if we show up, of us, people want more from us, and we don't have anything else to give. If we show up, we might garner more attention, and we're really happier in the corner. All those possibilities.
We're going to take a break in a moment, but one of the things that I'd like you to address when we come back is the comment that you made, the example that you gave, in terms of how it is that people might be afraid of success. Because, you know, on the outside looking in, it's hard to imagine that somebody could actually be afraid of being successful. People tend to see success as this wonderful, all of a sudden your life changes and everything is fabulous and wonderful and all the fairies are dancing, you know, on your side of the stream. But in fact, there are many people who are actually, on some levels, really frightened of what it could mean to be successful. And of course, we all have different versions of what success actually means. So we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to pick up there. Adele, we've been talking about balancing act, reflections, meditations, and coping strategies for today's fast-paced world. And as I said just before the break, we often hear people discuss the fact, not really discuss it, but just say, oh, she's afraid of success or he's afraid of success. But it doesn't really resonate for a lot of people. How could you possibly be afraid of success? When you're successful, your world is 360 degrees different and life is good and wonderful and you never have another problem. Who would be afraid of that?
Well, I'm laughing because people would be afraid of it. The studies have shown that often people who have fear of success also concomitantly have fear of failure, right? So they're afraid they'll blow it. They won't do a good job. They will be publicly ridiculed or shamed. That there is a piece of that, right? They think And so it scares them. It's not that happiness, I'm stepping into this, I can do this well. There's a piece where they have some self-doubt or some worry. And as we know with fears, they can be rational or irrational, right? Not necessarily that happened. You've also got, again, the phrase that if you look at Oprah, right? Oprah said that all of a sudden when she became very successful, that all of a sudden she had all these relatives she never knew she had, right? Everybody wanted a piece of her. And that can be exhausting. You know, there's more, you're in higher stratospheres, you're in brighter light, so to speak, and more will be required and asked of you. And it may feel like too much for you. But generally speaking, it's that fear of failure which has to do with perfectionism and fearing that you will muck it up in some profound way.
You quote Margaret Atwood, and it's an interesting quote, because certainly there are some people who would drive them crazy, and other people would feel really sort of relaxed about this observation. Margaret Atwood says, "When nothing is certain, everything is possible." What do you say about that?
I love that. That's why it's there. I love that because it's true. It's the mystery. It's when we surrender, we're not controlling or managing or micromanaging everything. It's being in the here and now. You know, everything is about mindfulness right now, right? The EQ, the emotional quotient, or they call it EI, emotional intelligence, and they also call it ESI, emotional and social intelligence. And out of all of that, you know, you're being mindful and you're being authentic in your feelings, which is scary. So if you're really willing to step in and be in the moment, be your true self without equivocation, you never know what magic can happen and how things unfold. We're often very guarded. I'm not saying that you let all of your gutty works, you know, fall out of you at the office. But I am saying working hard to be who you are. And when we don't control things, I have a perfect example. So years ago, I was a director of a substance abuse clinic, an urban clinic, and we had some satellite groups around. And the woman who was like our number one admin, Pearl, she was retiring. So we were organizing something. So I said, okay, all right, folks, we're going to do this, and we'll do a lunch, which was very unusual. It would be 40 people coming in from satellites in the office and how you schedule clients and what have you. And they all called me up, and for some, the gods must have been with me, and they said, okay, Del, what do I bring? I said, whatever you want. What do you mean, whatever I want? And they were all terrified that we would end up with lots of dip and brownies, and nobody would get real lunch. But the beauty of all of that is I laughingly said I let down my master control of the universe. People ended up talking to one another. We had perfectly balanced lunch with lots of good stuff, and we were not so heavy on the brownies. And Pearl had a good part. Someone said, oh, I'm bringing decorations. I'm bringing decorations. Okay, I'm bringing food. Okay, great. I'm bringing this. I'll bring the paper plates. Then everybody worked it out. They tried, and it worked out, and I was not a nut job running around with the, you know, because I always say the joke about me is, you know, give her a clipboard and a whistle. That's what I look like. So, you know, we're going to organize this. So I wasn't doing that, and they weren't used to me not doing that either. They're like, what's wrong with you? I'm like, no, we're going to just go with the flow here. And it was a powerful lesson for me, A, that I don't have to do anything, B, I could trust other people to figure it out, right? And see, they could be their most creative, wonderful self. And in that figuring out, it was great. And so in that small example, all things were possible, and they turned out well.
It's interesting that you use the term go with the flow, because, of course, you have a comment about the flow of focus. So let's talk about focus, because, you know, a lot of times, the sense is that it takes a lot of work to focus, and the word flow kind of gives you the sense that things are free and easy and sort of intuitive. But when you put those two together, they don't kind of seem to fit for a lot of people. What do you mean when you say the flow of focus?
Well, I can go back to the new word of the day, mindfulness, right? Just, you know, it's being... Everybody's grabbing for a piece of our attention, right? We know that in today's world, whether it's ads or TV or online or family member, everybody wants to get our attention. Even when you go to the supermarket now, they have ads on the shopping carts, right? I mean, it's everybody wants wants to kind of co-opt your thinking or manage, maybe that's a better word, manage your thinking and also your buying potential, right? That's what all that's about. But the flow of focus, right, is just saying, okay, here I am. I am, this is what I'm attend. If we attend to ourselves first, again, we go back to like you're on the plane and, you know, okay, parents, when those oxygen masks come down, if they come down, use yours first. And I remember the first time I heard that, I thought they were out of their minds. But then I grew to understand what they meant, and the same thing here. Okay, and I choose where I'm going to place my attention, where I'm going to place my focus. And in doing that, right, if I'm taking a walk, oh, I can look at the trees and the flowers and the birds, and isn't that a cute dog over there, and do that. If I'm at work, I'm going to be focused on, all right, well, I need to be taken care of here. Who am I talking to next? Those kinds of things. But I think focus can be a flow when we're in alignment with ourselves and when we're congruent. When we've got all these other things telling us what to think or what to do, and obviously this is not so much TV or online stuff, but it's, you know, feeling the demands, we choose where we're going to put our focus. I often think one of the best things to do is when you're feeling overwhelmed, you say to yourself, you know, there used to be the old standard where you make your list and you qualify. These are my A things, these are my B things, and these are my C things. And you still have 22 things on your list. And I just, you know, when you're sick and you say to yourself, okay, I can just get 3 things done today, and then I'll feel like a successful day. Well, I have, you know, gone down now, so I don't make lists with, I'll have 22 things on them, but it doesn't mean that I know they're for the week. That doesn't mean I'm going to get them done every day. And if they don't get done, they get carried over to the next week. But every day I say to myself, what are the things that I have to do today? And then I leave room for everything else.
And, you know, that's a wonderful way to actually orchestrate one's life, because you're taking care of the must-dos and the what comes up that I need to pay attention to's.
Right, right. And because we often say, oh, I've got to do this and I've got to do that. But the reality is your world is not going to fall apart if you don't do whatever that other thing is. And we put too much on. I love doing to-do lists, but I look at them and they're guides. They're not have-tos, and I'm not punishing myself. But there's certain things every day that are important that I get done, and I want to make sure that I do those.
The part of your book in which you talk about resentments, I think that's a big piece for a lot of people. And certainly when you have done work with those who have suffered almost horrifying traumas, resentment is in there somewhere, whether it's why did this hurricane happen to me? I didn't deserve it. Or why did this person do this to me and now they're doing fine and I'm falling apart? I mean, resentments show up in a lot of different ways. And once they're there, I would suggest that a lot of times people have a hard time letting go of resentments and actually resent being told to let go of resentments.
They do. How dare you? I have every right to feel that way.
So,
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, how do we think about how do we deal with resentments?
Well, I have a thing. I often say resentments are where we haven't taken responsibility for ourselves. And I want to say that gets a large hue and cry when I first say that. But here's what I mean. I mean, obviously, if you're in a hurricane and you've lost your things, there wasn't anything you could have done about that particular. But if you are resenting someone, oh, she wrote a book and I didn't and la, 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 well, then you say, all right, if you really want to do that, then you do that. And if you don't want to do that, you can let it go. But, you know, when we have resentments, we're not taking care of ourselves. Resentments are, it's another one of those, like a yellow warning flag coming up saying, all right, something's out of whack here. What is going on that this makes me so unhappy? And then we always have our choices. We can make a choice to do something differently. We can accept what is, or we can walk away from the situation that's making us crazy. But the deciding, all right, how am I going to deal with these resentments, so it doesn't take away all of my energy, all of my personal power, and I get all twisted in a knot, and it is a toxic stupor to be hanging out in deep resentment. You know, you are furious at the other person or the situation, or how could they? And sometimes you don't even express the other person how you are, but you hold deep, long-seated, simmering resentments, and it's toxic. You know, there are places in our lives where we accept. It doesn't mean we have to agree. It just means that we accept. This is the reality in front of me. How do I choose to deal with it?
You know, I think about, I see a lot of couples and individuals where the issue is, you know, he done me wrong, she done me wrong. So, you know, if she's feeling dumped, if you will, by her partner, and right. then in her world, 2 minutes later, her partner is in this wonderful relationship and they're just having a fabulous time. She is going to resent actually not only her partner, but the person she sees as her replacement. Or yep. her partner told her a huge lie that she believed, and now she knows it's not the truth, and she's resenting the partner. Those are things that, you know, very often kind of get into the nooks and crannies, if you will, of one's feelings of hurt and betrayal and loss and all of that. How do you make the choice? Can you make the choice to say, okay, this is what it is, but I'm going to do something different with how I negotiate it? Can you really do that? Or should you do that?
Well, I think, again, it's part of the journey of consciousness. You don't want to lose yourself. And I have worked with people who have been so bitter and resentful after terrible divorces and falsehoods, and that can be have severe ramifications within the family. And they're wild. They're absolutely, and I get why they're wild. And you have to work out why you're wild and why you're angry. And usually it's for pretty good reason here in this kind of circumstance we're talking about, you know, the lying and the betrayal. But I also think the betrayal is another one of those. It's another heart journey. And you can decide to give all of your energy to that, or you can then say, all right, how do I pull myself together and become the best that I can be? Because it is, it's a choice point. It's all a choice point. Does it make it better that he or she did you wrong? No. It's a terrible thing that you were done wrong. You know, have we all hurt people? Have we all been hurt by other people? Yes, in varying degrees, some way more than others. And it's a painful place to be in. I'm not saying diminish the pain, but I don't think we have to live in it forever. I think we have to say, okay, you're angry, and I get it. Well, here's what, but that comparison thing, you know, you get on to building your life or how it is. I know one woman, she was left because of whatever craziness her husband did, paying for years and years and years and working into her 70s because she was left with tax bills in her name. Because of what he did, and she was not a happy camper, and I understood why she was not a happy camper, and for very good reason. But if she stayed in the poison, she was just going to poison herself from the inside out. And you have to say, all right, it is. I don't like it. I'm going to deal with it the best I can, and I'm going to get on to the business of taking care of me.
So when people say let go of your resentments, very often that's heard as, oh, just forget about it.
But, oh, God, no, because how are you going to forget about it? It has pierced your heart. It has, you get so upset. You get so angry. You're wild. You know, how could they? How could they do this to me? And I trusted them. And that betrayal is, it brings you to your knees. It's a sucker punch to the gut. Let's not fool ourselves. You don't forget about it. But you look at it, you grieve it, you feel it, but you don't stay in the stupor of toxicity.
So it's the same concept that we discuss when we're talking about the value of forgiveness, the value to the individual versus holding on to the anger.
Right. I mean, you and forgiveness says, you know, because if we don't forgive, then we're hurting ourselves and it's not doing anything else to the other person, right? Yeah, so that's what happens there. And forgiveness can be a big, long process, and that's fine. I mean, you know, everybody takes as long as they need to take to process whatever they need to process. These are not easy things. You know, when somebody you've loved and trusted and shared your life with betrays you in profound ways, it's very hard to pick up the pieces and to get going again. And, you know, I know people who have said, oh, yes, and I did this to them and that to them on the fly, thinking they would feel better doing mean and nasty things, but it was momentary. It didn't last. And it made them somebody they didn't want to be as well, right? We're not all living soap opera lives, but we get hurt badly, hugely, enormously. We have to figure out how to get out of it and reclaim ourselves. And then open ourselves up for something else if we want that, you know. Open ourselves up, you know, we don't want to repeat the pattern, right? We don't want to repeat the pattern. But I know with some people that I've worked with over the years, there were places where, in these situations, I certainly not to say all, where they knew things were going on, they just never wanted to bring it to the fore for all sorts of reasons, you know. They'd have to deal with it. They'd have to face it, or they'd have to whatever. And there are some people who also enjoy being the victim. They will pummel you with it, lead with it, introduce and identify themselves as a victim. And it gives them some kind of, they believe, social currency in the world.
When you say enjoy being a victim, you know that there are people listening who may be saying, I told you that's why she stayed in that abusive relationship. I told you that's why he didn't leave that so-and-so person. They just enjoy being victims.
Well, I'm glad you said that, Pamela, and I don't mean that. I mean, I know a woman who went into a corporate meeting. Her daughter had died 10 years previously. 10 years previously. Of a brain tumor. And she leads the meeting with, my daughter died of a brain tumor. This is 10 years after the fact. Totally out of context, inappropriate, but meant to get what she wanted out of the meeting, right? Or looking for people to feel badly or sorry for you or that kind of thing. There are times we all need sympathy and support. And when I say victim, I'm not talking about somebody who has been victimized by a loved one, you know, abused or hurt. No, I mean, there's a whole psychology. I did a lot of work on those hotlines, and there's such a psychology of why people stay. You know, they stay because it's all they know, or they've been beaten down so much they believe that it doesn't make any difference, you know. In abuse situations, people are left isolated. That, you know, the person who's doing the abusing, and frequently it's a man, doesn't want his woman to have other friends, other people to talk to. He wants all of her power to come from him. So he will make sure that, you know, she's not seeing people. He will control her life because that's what makes him feel like a big man, and to hurt her and diminish her and put her down. And that a person in that situation doesn't stay there because they love it. They stay there because they don't have the mindset, the skill set, or the belief that they can make a move. I, you know, for years worked on a domestic violence hotline, and we had a safe house for women. And part of the deal of the safe house was women and children. You cannot not tell anybody where it is. And I get a phone call one time in the middle of the night, and one of the women had gotten the phone and called her abusive husband, and he's outside the gates. Well, not only does that harm this woman and her child, but all the other women inside, the word would travel, right? This is where you go. This is what you do. And, you know, that was not a good idea. So the, you know, victim in that sense, anybody who's being harmed, you know, but people who are victimized by their life circumstances to the point that they are having trouble finding resolution, and they lead with that woundedness. Some people enjoy using that as a baton to beat other people over the head with.
Gotcha. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue with Dr. Adele Ryan-McDowell. And I'd like to talk about your observation that we are hardwired for connection. We've been talking about how painful and challenging some connections can be, and but you're saying that we're hardwired for them. So what are our choices? What are our options? We'll pick up there when we return. Folks, don't go away. You're listening to Mind Talk, and my name is Pamela Brewer. Be right back. Adele, we talk about being hardwired for connection. And as I said just before the break, we're also talking about some of the challenges of trying to connect. So are we stuck? I mean, you're saying that we cannot escape relationships. So are we just stuck?
Why would that be a stuck thing? I mean, relationships are the connective tissue of life. They're what give us joy and, yes, heartache. And confusion and anger and all those other things, but it's what makes the world go around, right? When we think of our happy memories, you know, more often than not, you're going to think about sharing something with a loved one. We start with the family, right? And that's where we learn how to be with one another socially. And we go through life dealing with people, and relationships are his teachers. They are his teachers. The biggest lesson that the biggest lesson that the relationship teaches is unconditional love, and you often see this with a parent and a child, you know, that never knew that they could feel that way, be moved that deeply, and love that purely. But they teach us when we love someone deeply, we love them, right? Doesn't mean we like everything they do. We might say, no, I don't like that you're doing X, Y, or Z, but doesn't take away from the fact that I love you. And relationships are mirrors. They mirror back to us how we are. Relationships can be safe harbors, right? They can, you know, give us a place to mend and come back together again and what have you. It's, you know, that expression that you have friends for, what is it, reasons, seasons, and something else. And when you think of relationships like that, too, different people come into our lives at different times. We are hardwired for connection, for social beings, and for those of us who are more introverted than extroverted, we love our quiet time, but we, you know, our relationships are meaningful. And then, and, you know, on the downside, people who do not have good relationships are not as happy or as healthy. And that's research out of Harvard, right? So we all do better, but, and it's not the quantity of relationships, it's the quality, right? There's a story that the late, great Angela Azarian used to tell, a cultural anthropologist, and it's a hospital in California, and it's a ward where kids are, and they've all been there for a while. And the kids all perk up, and when there's one woman, and she's a cleaning lady who comes through every day, and she'll say, hello, Angela, oh, you've got purple on, it's my favorite color. Look at you, Claudine, to another picture. She knew each one of the kids, and they measured this woman brought the kids more joy than the nurses and the rest of the staff. Why? Because she saw all the kids individually, and she recognized them, and she gave them some kind of loving connection. And yes, the kids have parents and siblings and everybody else, but it was this woman who was keeping the ward neat and clean, who brought the most joy to the kids. Relationships matter. And they don't have to be lifelong, obviously, but we're wired that way. And we go back to the EQ, the emotional quotient, and it's how we relate to others and learning how to hear them and let them hear us and be authentic. And this is how we, this is how also we go about changing the world, right? It's relationship one by one, like beads on a necklace, one by one. You don't have to agree in all places, no, but finding common ground. You know, there are many of us who feel, for example, the environment is a worthwhile cause to fight for, right? And that's important. You know, let's love Mother Earth, too. How we come together and how we do that. Relationships, we can't avoid them. They're our greatest teachers, and sometimes they can be the biggest pain on the backside.
However, I'm not going to comment on that, although I completely agree, but I'm not commenting, you understand. You know, what makes us human is our ability and our wish and our need to connect. Would you say?
Yes, well said, absolutely.
We have been talking about, again, the book that you have written, Balancing Act. And there's a point in it when you make the observation that we think of balance as a temporary resting place. And it's true. I mean, a lot of times we think that balance is this thing that sort of is a teeter-totter and you have to hold on to it gently because it's not going to last for very long. You say that that is inaccurate and that balance is, in fact, an active state, that there's nothing passive about it. So help us understand how to think about balance as an active state that requires energy and tenacity and attention.
Okay, good. Well, the whole idea is balance is the portal for everything, really. It's the portal for healing on many levels. It's the place where we're able to do things, because when we're out of balance, we're out of balance, we're out of whack. And to change things, we need to get back to center. So balance is it's being mindful, it's our focus, it's our attention. It's also an open heart, because if we have a closed heart, we're out of balance. It is very much a heart-centered activity, and staying open. And balance is going to, you know, from day to day. Somebody wrote me this morning and said, oh, I was down all weekend. I had a migraine, right? Well, clearly, because they were physically out of balance and mind and body are connected, they would have been emotionally and mentally out of balance, right? They couldn't do the same things they did. But once the medication kicked in and they felt better, they were going to be able to refine balance. But looking for, and it's hard. It is really hard. You know, it is the holy grail in my life, let me tell you. You know, you talk about what you have to learn, and balance is one of those things. I'm being open to, in my day, we call them teeter-totters, or, you know, where you have seesaws, right?
Yes.
And you're on a seesaw. And, you know, one, you go up or down, but that midpoint, that fulcrum point, is ideally, we have to be flexible. We always have to keep our metaphoric and literal knees bent, because we don't know what's coming around the corner, but we're going to be flexible. And by being balanced, says, I'm open. I'm open. I'm open. I am aware. I am present. And we also have to know about ourselves. We're finding out now more and more that keeping our body balanced helps keep the rest of us balanced, right? You know, with kids, and you think, oh my God, and how, the teachers always hate the day after Halloween because the kids are all jacked up on sugar, right?
And some of the adults too.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. Yeah, it'd probably be one of them. So it's the, you know, finding that place of, you know, reminding ourselves, okay, balance. Buddha was right, you know, living the middle way, the moderate way is helpful. Physically, you know, mentally also, you know, we live in a country and a world that is very divided in many, many ways. And it is so easy to get to one place and hold on to it tenaciously. I understand that. But I also think we serve ourselves by being open and just hearing other points of view, becoming aware so that we're more balanced, right? There's more inflow and outflow. Doesn't mean we have to agree with what we're not agreeing with, but it's just being balanced in how we understand it. I'm sure you, in couples work, the idea is, okay, let's walk in one another's shoes, right? Let's understand, let's become more balanced, come closer together and meet things. So, you know, balance doesn't want us to be that pretzeled up person, right? Balance wants us kind of standing with flexible knees, maybe going from side to side, open-hearted, saying, okay, life, here I am. But it's hard. It's really hard. But I've been thinking a lot about balance as a portal recently, and just understanding how much, if we're in a balanced place, we can be open to. And it's very helpful.
You make the comment, it's a quote actually that you share, and I guess I kind of selfishly wish that all of us could hear it and really take it on, particularly those who are in positions of power. You quote Robert Anthony and say, quote him by saying, when you blame others, you give up your power to change. My, oh my.
I know, because we're so busy saying you so-and-so instead of saying, all right, what do I need to do here, right? Because there are times where you need to call someone to task and right or wrong, absolutely. But if we spend our life blaming somebody else, we're not plugged into ourselves, are we? No. And we're not being open to whatever the situation was, obviously becomes catalytic enough that we want to do something besides blame. You know, we did that 3 degrees. Let's shift to the right or shift to the left. What can we do here, right?
And again, you know, the notion that you don't have any liability or choice in whatever the action is. It's that not only are you giving up your power to change, but you're also saying that you see yourself as powerless. So you've got to give all the power to somebody else. And that's not true.
Exactly. So there's the Louis Pasteur story that's in the book. You know, he the father of pasteurization. He's in France, you know, centuries ago. He's very ill. And he reasons that if he were balanced, he could heal. Okay, I like this thinking. So, and he thought about the happiest times in his life, and that was being by the river with his mother, playing in the sand and the mud while she did the laundry. So he sent his lab folks out and said, bring me back sand, mud. Bring it, you know, so they come back with sun-warmed mud and sand. And he puts his hands and his feet in it, and he got well, right? Because, you know, he teed it all up for himself, right? But he felt sincerely that if he could take himself back to that feeling place of happiness, love, balance, connection, all of that, if he could be there, because when he was happy, he was balanced. And I would think many of us would say that when we're happy, we're feeling balanced. We're more generous, right? You know, we're more open to doing other things because we're happy. We don't second guess ourselves so much because we're in the moment and we're happy. Balance and happiness go hand in hand.
As we've been talking today about the various ways in which we can learn to balance, the various ways in which we can transition from the stress of our worlds into something that is more balanced and more choice-driven, you make the comment in I'm looking at the chapter in the emotional hangover chapter, and it's such a wonderful one. You remind us that there is always choice. Mm-hmm. Choice serves as the grace note to every interaction. Talk about choice for a moment.
Well, I think there is power in every choice we make. And some of them we do unthinkingly. You know, if I go to the grocery store and I want an apple, I'll pick some up and see which ones I want, right? But there, I think there's choice. Everything we choose, right? Are we choosing to enhance our lives? Are we choosing to make somebody else happy? Are we choosing because we got to cover the rent? Whatever the deal is on how we make choice. Choice is very important, and choice is how we see things. You know, there's some people who are forever optimists, like, you know, the story of the guy who goes into the ER and he's been terribly hurt, and he says, Doc, am I going to make it? And the doc says, well, we'll do our best. No, of course I'm going to make it. And everybody he sees, yes, I'm going to make it. And, of course, he did make it, right? And good medical care, power of positive thinking, grace knows there, combination thereof. But, you know, how we choose to see life, how we choose to see one another, how we choose to take care of ourselves. That's the hardest. Oh, my gosh. We'll do it for everybody else, but it's really hard for us to do it for ourselves. And say, all right, let me stop. What can I do for me? Can I choose me? I had someone call me yesterday and say, all right, you know, I've been offered X, and I'm going to lose money doing it. And I'm like, well, how would you feel? Well, I'd feel resentful. Well, so would that be a good idea to do that then, you know? And everything we do is about choice. But I would add, do we remember to choose ourselves as well?
And that is such an important piece. If we all understood that we really do have choice, and sometimes we don't like the choices that we have, but right. we really do have them, and that's important. And I just want to close out our conversation today again by quoting this woman. You may know her, Adele Ryan McDowell. she says, there is a certain elegance in being able to disengage from trauma and not play the game. And that is so true. Thank you for saying that.
Oh, well, thank you. I always said the gods were right there with me when I was doing this. And so I'm glad that you like that. That pleases me. Thank you.
Give us an opportunity, Adele, to learn more about what you're doing, your writing, all the things you're into. Is there a website?
Yes, I've got several. We've got AdeleRyanMcDowell.com, and there's a blog, AdeleAndThePenguin.com, where we make sense of an upside-down world. And I wrote a suicide book, so there's MakingPeaceWithSuicide.com. And then for those who are more spiritually minded, there's ChannelsGrace.com.
Wonderful. Again, Adele Ryan McDowell, author of Balancing Act and several other books that you've heard, Reflections, Meditations, and Coping Strategies for Today's Fast-Paced World. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could take this guidance and really transition from the craziness that many of us live to something that's a bit more peaceful, a bit more mindful, a bit more loving of self and others. Again, Adele, I thank you. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with the professional of your choosing. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to Mind Talk, so send me an email. Send it to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. That's MYNDTALK.org. And again, Mind Talk is available on demand by going to the Mind Talk website. You can subscribe to the Mind Talk podcast via iTunes, or you can download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes Store and from Google Play. Remember always, if it's unacceptable, that's what it is. Unacceptable. You take it.